from KNX News 97.1 FM.
This is Countdown 2024.
Brought to you by LMU Loyola Law School.
Here are Charles Feldman and Margaret Carrero.
1 week ago today, Americans made the choice to send Donald Trump back to the White House. And we are tracking the 69 days until the president-elect is sworn back into office. On today's Countdown 2024, we will look at why Donald Trump's victory and Kamala Harris's defeat were generations in the making because of deep-seated economic patterns in this country. And we'll ask whether Trump can do anything to change those patterns. And we are picking through the first round of cabinet appointments for clues to how Trump will govern during his second go of it.
President-elect Trump continues to add to his administration with several choices that have defied expectations. Trump, who campaigned on being a peacetime president who wouldn't look to start any new wars, picked Florida Senator Marco Rubio as his Secretary of State and Florida Congressman Mike Waltz as his National Security Advisor. Both men favor a hawkish foreign policy. Both have been supportive of Ukraine in its war against Russia, and both have been very tough on China. South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem is Trump's pick to head the Department of Homeland Security, while former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee was tapped to be the next U.S. ambassador to Israel.
Democrat George Whitesides was declared the winner in the 27th Congressional District, ousting Republican incumbent Mike Garcia. Two other Southern California races, which will help to determine control of Congress, remain too close to call. Republican incumbent Michelle Steele maintaining a slim lead on Democratic challenger Derek Tran in their Orange County district, while Democrat Dave Minn is holding a small lead over Republican Scott Baugh in Katie Porter's old congressional district. And yes, a week after Election Day, California continues to slowly count votes.
While Donald Trump heads to the White House tomorrow to meet with outgoing President Joe Biden, First Lady Melania Trump will be skipping the trip and the traditional meeting with her counterpart, Jill Biden. Melania's team cited scheduling conflicts. In 2020, neither Joe nor Jill Biden were extended an invitation from Trump to meet in the White House, as the now president-elect was working to overturn his election loss to Biden.
The reasons for Kamala Harris's loss to Donald Trump have been well discussed and dissected over the past week, and the biggest culprit seems to be the economic anxieties and worries of many Americans. Our guest argues that these issues were generations in the making and doubts whether Trump has any ability or interest in fixing them. Catherine Ann Edwards is an economist at the Rand Corporation, a Bloomberg News columnist, and an economic policy consultant. Catherine, thanks for being with us. So let me ask you, I get your argument that real wages for most Americans have not really improved when you factor in inflation over what? I think it's something like five decades you figured. And so they can't afford housing and big ticket items like college educations and things like that. But can any politician really solve that problem? Because there are so many reasons why that's the case.
I think the question is whether or not they're expected to solve it within, you know, a rather arbitrary four-year term of office, or if they're putting us on the right course. If the answer is, can we fix everything in 4 years? Certainly not. But can we move in the right direction? Hopefully so. I think what worries me most about the economic policies, to the extent that they're economic policies that have been proposed by Trump for his second term, you know, none of them would be positive for the bottom 60% of workers in any real or tangible way.
Okay, but let's take just one of the items, real wages. What would your solution be to that?
Okay, so how do we get wages to grow faster?
Yeah.
Well, the kind of classic story of how you get wages to grow faster in the United States is to have a tight labor market that favors low unemployment. And indeed, the fastest that the bottom 60 to 50% of American workers have seen their wages grow has really been in the past 10 years, when we've had labor markets tend towards being tight as opposed towards being loose. But that's not all we can do. The other thing we can do is enforce the labor law that we have, which we haven't really been too inclined to do, things like enforcing the wage and hour divisions mandate for overtime, for enforcement of child labor laws. We could raise the minimum wage. But this is another way of asking, where do good jobs come from that lead to the types of wages that Americans want. And I think there we're starting to see what that policy should look like. You know, Biden's CHIPS Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, and the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, those were three pieces of legislation that hoped to bring high-paying jobs to build a better infrastructure and future economy here in the U.S. For what it's worth, I think we could do with a lot more unionization. We always talk about this, you know, white working class male that used to have a manufacturing job. And there's nothing special about sitting in a hot, crowded room, you know, taping up a box for 8 hours, except that it paid well and you got health and retirement. There's lots of jobs that don't have either of those things that we could make into the manufacturing jobs of yesteryear if we were willing to extend those types of unionized protection to workers, jobs that can't be exported, like cooks in the kitchen.
So that's solutions for the real wage growth, how much money people actually earn. What about the other component of how much things cost? Solutions for that?
That, I think, requires a market by market approach. You know, you want to hit the labor market with everything positive you got to help the American worker. But, you know, what would solve the housing market for Americans to make housing more affordable is not the same thing that would make, say, childcare more affordable, which is not what would make college tuition more affordable. You'd want to have tailored approaches for kind of each of these big ticket items. You know, what I like to point out is that if your wages are growing just with inflation, you can afford things that grow slower than inflation, which in the U.S. includes household appliances, household furniture, clothing, toys, smartphones, electronics, TVs. Those have slower price growth than prices overall. They become more affordable to you. Housing, childcare, healthcare, elder care, college tuition, those have all grown much faster than prices overall. And there are a lot of the pain points for Americans. You know, that's a problem 50 years in the making. You know, the idea of having tailored solutions. So I would say, you know, on the childcare side, this should not be a market good. It might sound crazy when I say it like this, but it's just really hard to make the, you know, 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds that profitable. On the housing side, we need to have more building.
Catherine Ann Edwards, this is who we're speaking with, an economist with the RAND Corporation.
The fact that this has been going on, as you put it, for 5 decades, maybe even a little more, this disparity in income versus the real cost of some big ticket items, would suggest that both Republicans and Democrats really didn't want to do anything, because if they did, in 50 years, they would have done it.
Or they didn't do anything that successfully.
But they're not stupid people, so they must realize all the things that we're, you know, that you're talking about. So, you know, if it didn't succeed in 5 years, maybe, or 10 years, but if it didn't succeed in doing these things in half a century through Republicans and Democrats and liberal administrations and conservative administrations, it awfully sounds as if it's because they want it to be this way.
Or because they have put too much faith in the solutions that they prefer, the ones that might be less scary for them. You know, if we've grown up in this era. I mean, those 5 decades coincides with a lot of market deregulation, a rise of neoliberal economic thinking that the market has to have right away, you know, no matter what. This also coincides with an era in which having, you know, right-sized tax policy means that you have to cut taxes no matter what. And I think that wanting to believe in the solution doesn't necessarily make you a bad person or make you trying to mistreat Americans. You think that it's going to work if you just give it more time. And this election, this anger that you feel from so many Americans, you know, you've had time. You've had 50 years of runway. So now let's start aggressively raising the minimum wage, or start aggressively pushing for unionization, or take over the childcare market and have it be a right as much as public education is. These are things that we haven't tried. And we've tried tax cuts. We've tried them 4 times. We'll probably try them for a fifth within the next 2 years. We've spent around $8 trillion cutting taxes to help Americans feel more secure in the economy. The extension of the Trump tax cuts are supposed to cost around $4.5 trillion. So we'll put around $12 trillion into cutting taxes to solve most everything. And it won't work again because it hasn't worked before. And it's time to actually start building some solutions.
So if you were able to be in the ear of the president-elect Trump, what would you tell him?
I'm not sure. He doesn't really strike me as someone who likes to listen to people who think they're smarter than him.
Well, let's pretend for
Let's
the moment
pretend.
that he'll actually listen. What would you tell him?
I would tell him that you're going to get a really nice dopamine hit of just feeling good, punishing people, of let's punish Mexico, let's punish China. It doesn't matter that we import, $40 billion worth of food from Mexico, our largest trading partner. Sure, slap them with a tariff. You mean you can cause so much economic destruction that that will be your legacy. That's what tariffs and deportation will mean. It is economic destruction. There is no other word for it. It's not a consequence. It's not an effect. It is destruction of parts of our economy. Consumers aren't the only one that pay for imported goods. Our producers do as well. I mean, this is a tax on current producers by increasing the inputs they use in production. There's a lot of economic costs coming down the line from these policies and no solution in sight. And I think that it'll feel nice to, I'm so mad that people came over the border illegally from Mexico, so let's slap a tariff on them. But I don't think that that will help Americans. And the legacy won't be on how he made people feel in 2025, but how people will look back on him in 2035. And it will not be kindly.
All right, RAND Corporation economist Catherine Ann Edwards. Thank you.
Donald Trump is getting busy stocking up his cabinet, and some of his picks will surprise you. Countdown 2024 is brought to you by LMU, Loyola Law School, where students ignite justice, lls.edu/radio.
It's Countdown 2024
on KNX News 97.1 FM. This is Countdown 2024
on KNX News 97.1 FM.
Welcome back. Along with Charles Feldman, I'm Margaret Carrero. In some ways, Donald Trump's first choice is to fill out his administration track well. The president-elect certainly seems to be following through on his promises of muscular immigration enforcement by appointing South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem to head the Department of Homeland Security and immigration hardliner Tom Homan as his border czar. But in a few other cases, the future 47th president has made some wily picks.
Yeah, for a man with a well-established affinity for Russian President Vladimir Putin, who ran on a platform of promising to end several global wars, Trump has made some aggressive foreign policy picks, people who can't really be described as peaceniks. Dave Weigel is the national politics reporter for Semaphore. Following all of this, Dave, thank you. Rubio is not exactly a non-aggressive character. Why would a president who says America first, he doesn't want to get into wars, he thinks the Democrats have gotten us into too many wars, why would he pick some folks that might be a little bit more prone to do that?
At the risk of sounding cynical, Donald Trump says a lot of things to a lot of people. One dynamic that's played out, and you were sort of hinting at it, he was campaigning in Michigan, saying both to Jewish voters that he was going to defend Israel and to the hilt support its annexation of the West Bank, and then telling voters who wanted a ceasefire, wanted a Palestinian state, that he'd work for them too. So there are a few Trump priorities that just were incompatible, and you're starting to see some of the effects in these appointments. Now, Rubio in 2015 was seen by the MAGA movement as a neoconservative, as a war hawk, etc. He was pretty simpatico with Trump on the Iran deal, which was the main, if you're looking at what Trump did that was not concordant with being a peace president, it was getting out of the Iran deal. They agreed on that. Rubio was very aggressive in trying to overturn or delegitimize governments in Latin America that Trump also was trying to delegitimize, like Maduro in Venezuela. So they agree on some of these priorities, but I go back to that Israel point, because Trump, as a non-incumbent who could say there were fewer foreign wars, not that the U.S. was involved in, but our proxies were involved in when I was president, he just argued, yeah, there'd be peace when I win, and we'll color in the details later. Here are the details.
Talk a little bit about the logic of putting Kristi Noem in charge of the Department of Homeland Security. This is a massive, complicated federal security agency. Trump wants to do these complex, he promises, complex mass deportations. Do you think she's going to be up to the task?
To parts of the task, the public-facing part of the task, Trump team is very confident in her as a spokesman, as a face of the agency. It's also going to want, in a reversal from 8 years ago, somebody in that job who can take a lot of flack, who's not going to wilt if Democrats or the media are saying, look how horrible that your deportation policies are. So that part, yes. But the important appointees in DHS, and for a lot of agencies, especially DHS, are going to be other people who might not be Senate confirmed or can be put in there as acting officials and do their work without a Senate vote or political appointees. So this is not somebody in Kristi Noem. She's been a governor. She's been a member of Congress. But she has not been one of the intellectual or policy leaders of the Trump Stephen Miller immigration policy. She is somebody who is more likely to work in tandem with them and with these political appointees below her to enact the Trump agenda and be the public face for it.
One of the things that is really obvious, I think, is not just the people that Trump so far is selecting, but the way he's doing it. It's a much faster pace, right, than it was the first time he was in the White House when he really took his time naming people and was, mm-hmm. and was even criticized for it. But also he wants to have the cabinet members approved, sort of rubber stamped without going through hearings, right?
That is possible. He'll meet some resistance, and the Senate does take, no matter who runs it, the advisory and consent role seriously. It also, since 2015, maybe a little bit earlier, the Democrats changed appointment rules. They got rid of the filibuster for these nominees. So nobody who's not compromised in some important way couldn't get a Republican majority to sail them through. This was not a problem in Trump's. In Trump's first term, he only lost nominees for scandal reasons. They want to move ahead quickly, but this is why I point to the acting officials part of this. Is there's not in 2016 there was a little bit of chaos. There weren't, compared to a normal Republican nominee who won, not that many people in the Trump orbit who were ready to take these jobs on, who understood the federal government. And the difference this time is there are just lists and lists of people who know how to do this stuff who are going to be moved in. Now, you probably heard about some of it during the election in coverage of the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025. The message from Trump, because that was quite unpopular, was that none of those people were going to be part of the administration. They were dead to him, et cetera, et cetera. Tom Homan was a contributor to that, and he's already going to be rejoining the administration. I have his book on my desk. You can find him. He's going to be joining the administration and handling immigration policy again. So you are going to see people in the conservative orbit who might not be super famous or might not be leaving the Senate or governor's mansion, who have a record and maybe a written record of being willing to implement Trump's ideas in these jobs.
Dave Weigel, we are talking with him. He is the national politics reporter for Semaphore, and we will finish off our first look through Donald Trump's prospective cabinet next.
This is Countdown 2024
on KNX News 97.1 FM.
Welcome back to the Tuesday edition of Countdown 2024. Along with Charles Feldman, I'm Margaret Carrero. Dave Weigel from Semaphore remains with us to finish off our first look at Donald Trump's incoming cabinet.
Dave, for those who, for whatever reason, thought, well, maybe Trump isn't as serious as he says or said during the campaign about having mass deportation, you mentioned a name in passing, Stephen Miller, who I think gives a good indication what Trump's intent actually is. Can you briefly tell our listeners who Stephen Miller is and why it might be significant that he was part of the selection process?
Well, he was always going to be in a second Trump administration. This is a premise throughout the post-presidency, or I guess the interregnum now. Miller was lifted from, I wouldn't say obscurity, but semi-obscurity in the Senate as a Jeff Sessions spokesperson with immigration and border security views that did not comport with most Republicans at the time and do now. He was in large part responsible for, I would say, I'm trying not to underplay it, but immigration policies designed at making staying in the country illegally painful, making it hard for you to reunite with your family, making it impossible to live so that you get out of the country. That and out of the presidency, he was taking a lot of steps to find friendly courts that might rule for conservatives and sue to dismantle progressive race policies. So he'll be in the administration in an enhanced role, and he's going to do all that. And if you look at Trump between these two terms in the White House, there was a time when people like Miller were talking a lot about what their plans might be, going on podcasts, detailing them, etc. And Miller could go in detail about how, for example, mass deportation might work. And he stopped doing that, but the record is still there. And so Miller has said there's going to be some negative media coverage of what they're going to try to do, but that they are going to plow ahead, use all the tools of law enforcement. I mean, this is, for example, imagine somebody a checkpoint where somebody is stopped and there's a police officer asking for proof of citizenship. They don't have it. They can be processed and deported. All those sorts of tools. Miller is going to implement that with, I'd say, a fearlessness and a sense that any media criticism he gets is expected and irrelevant.
Dave Weigel from Semaphore. Thank you so much for joining us here on Countdown 2024.
Coming up on Wednesday's edition of Countdown, the conventional wisdom before the election was that if Donald Trump wins, Ukraine and NATO are in major trouble. But then the president-elect made some very curious appointments to his administration. We talked about some of them today. In fact, it could change some of that thinking. We will be talking about Trump and foreign policy tomorrow. If you missed the show, by the way, catch up on demand on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. All you have to do, by the way, is search Countdown 2024 and follow the show. Countdown 2024 is brought to you by LMU, Loyola Law School, where students ignite justice, lls.edu/radio.
The job market is constantly changing, and at Bowling Green State University, we're evolving too, working with industries to develop innovative majors in education, engineering, business, and healthcare that will give you an edge when you enter the workforce. BGSU is ranked as the number one public university in Ohio for career preparation by the Wall Street Journal. Personalized career coaching, networking opportunities, and hands-on immersive learning set you up for success. That's the BGSU experience. Learn more at bgsu.edu/careerready.